Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay.
The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas is now in session.
Thank you, may be seated. So good afternoon, I'll welcome everybody to the Second Court of Appeals today. We've got two oral arguments scheduled this afternoon, but only one with this panel. And I understand that the parties, the council have checked in with the clerk. And before we get started, as you can see, the justices that you have here before you today are to my left, Justice Brian Walker, to my right, Justice Dana Womack, and I am Elizabeth Kerr. And unless there are any housekeeping matters we need to take up, I'll ask the clerk to call the case. Thank you. You may proceed, Mr. Davis.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Jackson Davis and no relation to Devin Davis as far as I'm aware. I represent Mr. Fred Jordan and his wife, Mrs. Judith Jordan, in a case against Mrs. Jordan's treating doctor and later retained expert, Dr. Jeffrey Heitkamp. This is a case where Mr. Jordan underwent a surgery at the hands of Dr. Heitkamp in 2019, and shortly thereafter suffered from quadra equina syndrome and ultimately paraparesis. The Jordan's previous counsel consulted Dr. Heitkamp about the cause of Mr. Jordan's horrific outcome and retained him as an expert witness to pursue a case against the rehab doctor, doctor by the name of Dr. Peter Rappa, and the rehab facility Methodist Rehab, blaming them for not addressing Mr. Jordan's quadra equina syndrome properly and getting him to emergency surgery timely. During the litigation process, Dr. Heitkamp authored two expert reports, one in March of 2021 and another on May 4th, 2022. In each of these expert reports, he also saw Mr. Jordan in order to assess him in order to author these expert reports.
So are you saying that Dr. Heitkamp was treating Mr. Jordan when he was writing those expert reports?
Correct. He was actually treating Mr. Jordan when he was authoring these expert reports and gathering information for
them. What about when he gave his deposition in 2023?
He gave his deposition as a treating expert and as an expert witness. So he was also treating at that time as well. In neither of these cases during the expert reports did Dr. Heitkamp divulge that he was aware that Mr. Jordan showed the clinical signs of quadra equina syndrome before he left his care at the hospital. And fast forwarding to January of 2023, Dr. Heitkamp gave a deposition, again, as a treating expert and doctor and also as an expert witness, retained expert witness, where he shockingly, to the Jordans and Mr. Jordan's counsel at the time, admitted for the first time that he was aware that Mr. Jordan was showing the clinical signs of quadra equina prior to leaving his care at the hospital.
Does the record give us any indication of why there was a year and 4 months between the time of the deposition and when the Jordans sued Dr. Heitkamp?
The record discusses that, that what happened is Mr. Atkins, previous counsel for the Jordans, his health deteriorated late into 2023 after the deposition. The case unraveled against Dr. Rappa, and they ended up settling for a nominal amount. The Jordans found new counsel, I believe, in September or late 2023. At that time, investigation into the case, multiple pre-suit notice letters were sent, which is discussed in our reply brief. And eventually suit was filed, I believe, on May 16th of 2024. So the argument here is, the first thing that I want to discuss is that it's the defendant appellee's burden to establish that the claims were barred by limitations. It is the defendant's burden to definitively, conclusively prove the date of accrual, which they did not do in this case. So first, we're going to discuss, I'd like to discuss the negligence and gross negligence claims, and then we'll discuss the fraud claims later. The statute, as this court is well aware, is 2 years from the date of the last treatment. And it is told by 75 days if there is pre-suit notice sent 60 days prior, as this court's well aware. If notice is sent within 60 days of the lawsuit being filed, the remedy is not dismissal, it's abatement. In this case, notice was sent within 60 days, one of the notices. The prior four notices, or I think there were three before, were sent well before 60 days prior to the lawsuit being filed.
But those calculations come into play mostly if we're going off of the second report in May of 2022 as being the time of accrual.
Correct, and I think the reason that I bring that one up is because the point that I think pretty much everybody agrees that the earliest date of accrual is that May 4th date of 2022. I don't think there's a huge dispute there.
But okay, so help me, because I'm kind of struggling conceptually with thinking about how, I mean, writing, let's just say a false expert report, that piece of paper did not harm Mr. Jordan, but missing the symptoms, I guess, before he was discharged from the hospital post-surgery, wasn't that really when, I mean, wouldn't that be when the injury would have manifested itself and limitations would have started?
No, the limitations period does not start to accrue under that theory until the fraud is discovered. In this case, Dr. Heitkamp admitted in his deposition that he knew that Mr. Jordan had the signs of quad equina syndrome, and he, as the retained expert, failed to notify the Jordans, and our allegations are deliberately concealed it to avail himself of the statute of limitations defense for nearly 2 years. And I don't know if it was the being under oath in a deposition or a guilt of conscience, but at his deposition he admitted it, and that's when the Jordans first became aware of these claims that they had against Dr. Heitkamp.
If you don't mind, just recap really quick, factually, what things happen and when they happened that you believe are the accrual dates for each cause of action?
Yes. Okay. So the accrual date, the simplest one is the accrual date for negligence and gross negligence. The last date of treatment, if we take the deposition as treatment, it's clear that was in January of 2023. This case was filed in 2024 in May. That is well within the statute. If we take May 4th, which was the last expert report, this case was filed on May 16th of 2024, which is 2 years and I think 12 days after the date of accrual, but with the 75-day the 75-day period that tolls the statute, it was still within the statute. And that's what we're talking about has not been.
And that's the cause of action of?
That's the cause of action of negligence and gross negligence.
Yeah.
With respect to fraud, which was also pled, it could be a four-year statute, but that doesn't really apply to this case because the fraud was first discovered in 2023 at the deposition. So the statute for fraud would begin to run in January of 2023.
Okay.
Discussing further, I think that pretty much gets to the heart of the timeline that's important. I think the easiest way with the least amount of analysis needed is the negligence cause of action starting from May 4th, even if we take their date as true. But we still allege that January is when the 2 years starts to run. One thing that was also brought up, I think we've talked a little bit about fraudulent misrepresentation. That's, Dr. Heitkamp had a duty as the retained expert for the Jordans to be forthright, to be honest, and to tell them about causation. That's what he was hired for. The appellees have made an argument about judicial privilege. That does not apply in this case because judicial privilege applies to defamation, libel, slander claims made against opposing experts for testimony that they give during a case. It does not apply to a party's own expert. Dr. Heitkamp is not being sued in this case for the things that he said in a deposition because it was in court. He's being sued based on not telling the Jordans about their causes of action, which he was retained to do way back in 2021.
Well, is it accurate to say that, I mean, I assume that when Dr. Rapa's lawyer was deposing Dr. Heitkamp and he had the records from the surgery and what happened in the days before he was discharged to the rehab hospital, I mean, those records presumably revealed that he was showing CES symptoms. Wasn't that what Dr. Heitkamp agreed the records showed?
That he was showing signs of quadra equina in the hospital?
Yes.
Yes, he agreed for the first time in his deposition.
So I mean, those records are there, but you're saying that even though the records show what they show, because Dr. Heitkamp didn't fess up to what the records show, that in itself equates to fraudulent concealment? I mean, what is the test that you're wanting us to adopt here?
Sure. So the fraud is the fact that he knew and admitted that in his deposition that he had all the signs of quadra equina syndrome and did not reveal, even though that is exactly why he was retained by the Jordans to reveal, is the causation of his problems. He had already reviewed all those records and seen them and never told anyone until he was questioned under oath. So if he had never served as an expert, then it would be on the Jordans to hire an expert and investigate all the claims they may have and bring those claims. But the fact that he was retained as the expert, he had a duty to provide accurate and honest opinions to his own client, which he didn't do here. And that misrepresentation to the Jordans is the basis of the fraud claims. In this case, if judicial privilege were applied here, I don't think there's any way that it can, but I just wanted to point out that if it were applied in this case, it would be the first case in Texas to ever apply judicial privilege to a treating doctor who was retained as an expert. It is 100% of the time an adverse doctor who is giving testimony, and it has to be, the essence of the claim has to be defamation or libel. In this case, the key thing to remember is that Dr. Heitkamp was retained by the Jordans, and the Jordans were specifically investigating what happened here, and they relied on what Dr. Heitkamp was telling them as the causation in order to pursue their claims. There was one case cited by the appellees where the records were not given to the patient and they brought a claim for fraudulent concealment because they didn't provide them the records. And the court held that, well, in that case, they still have a duty to investigate their claims. Well, not only did the Jordans investigate their claims, they hired an expert, hired an attorney, filed a case against a doctor timely, and they pursued it diligently until that January deposition, where for the first time they learned, wait a minute, their own expert's now saying that it's his fault. So the...
Well, could you sort of say that people assume the risk when they hire their own doctor to be an expert witness to point the finger at somebody else? I mean, it's kind of a risky thing to do, I would think.
Well, I think when they hire somebody on causation, they expect them to be honest and they rely on those statements. And in this case, I don't think it was necessarily incumbent upon Dr. Heitkamp to implicate himself, but he certainly could have declined representation, which happens regularly in these cases, probably for this very reason, because they could become the targets of litigation. So in this case, they relied on his statements to pursue another case. Finally, I know I'm running out of time, so I'll just close with, we would ask the court to reverse and remand, because a doctor should not be able to fraudulently conceal his own negligence, have the injured party rely on those statements, and then not have any recourse judicially. And thank you for your time, and I've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Davis.
Thank you.
Ms. Davis?
May it please the court, my name is Devin Davis, and I represent appellee Dr. Jeffrey Heitkamp in this case. In my argument, I will discuss three reasons why this court should affirm the trial court's judgment granting Dr. Heitkamp's motion for summary judgment. First, all of appellant's claims are recast healthcare liability claims, subject to this 2-year statute of limitations under the Texas Medical Liabilities Act. Second, Dr. Heitkamp conclusively established that the 2-year statute of limitations bars their claims as a matter of law. Third, appellants did not raise a material fact issue to avoid summary judgment. And in the alternative, if the fraud claim is not considered a recast healthcare liability claim, then it's barred by the doctrine of judicial privilege. The majority of the facts are undisputed. The only surgery that Dr. Heitkamp performed on Mr. Jordan was in 2019. Mr. Jordan experienced the same symptoms pre- and post-operatively. Mr. Jordan presented with cauda equina compression. Dr. Heitkamp performed a surgery that was an attempt to alleviate that compression, but sometime after surgery, his compression worsened and developed into cauda equina syndrome. The medical records show that Mr. Jordan was able to walk after surgery, but then his condition worsened. There are no allegations made by appellants that anyone prevented the discovery of the medical records regarding the 2019 treatment at USMD Hospital or the subsequent treatment at the rehab facility. Dr. Heitkamp was hired by Mr. Jordan as an expert witness to opine on the causation of the injury that he sustained postoperatively. Mr. Jordan then filed suit against the rehab facility and Dr. Rappa, a doctor at the rehab facility, in 2021. Dr. Heitkamp was then deposed in that case and provided clarifying opinions regarding Mr. Jordan's cauda equina syndrome. Appellants then filed this present case in May 16th of 2024.
Was there ever a time that Dr. Heitkamp acknowledged that he had been wrong in his reports, other than when he was deposed?
In his first report that he drafted on February 10th was when he stated the cause of the cauda equina syndrome was the ulcer wound breakdown. And then on May 4th, 2022, his second expert report, he stated that the cause of the cauda equina syndrome, He stated that the reason that the standard of care was breached was because the Methodist Rehabilitation Hospital didn't recognize the Cauda-Equina syndrome quickly and then refer him back to Dr. Heitkamp for further treatment. So he did correct himself in his second expert report that was in May 4th of 2022.
But the distinction is that when he was deposed, he actually said that the symptomology started, that essentially the breach of the lack of care, in some ways he's saying that the breach of lack of care started with his treatment, and he had not said that before, correct? I mean, at least he said that.
He said that he clarified that there were symptoms of Cauda-Equina compression before he left USMD Hospital in his deposition.
Oh, I thought he'd agreed that there were symptoms of the syndrome.
I can pull up the direct.
I mean, that's a distinction between the syndrome.
Yeah, syndrome's the one that needs the emergency treatment, right?
So these are the two statements in the record. Question. We now know, as we talk through, that that's actually not accurate because there's a significant evidence of damage to the Cauda-Equina before leaving USMD. True? Dr. Heitkamp. Yeah, I really meant to say no compression on the bundle with the CT scan. Okay. Dr. Heitkamp. But yes, there are symptoms of the syndrome. Okay. Symptoms of the syndrome. Question. We have a clinical picture of Cauda-Equina. Dr. Heitkamp. Right.
So to that, what's your position? I guess in response, I mean, you heard what appellant said about the fraud statute and how that's when really the fraud was manifested and that's when the statute starts.
So even if
your alternative argument is that it would be judicial privilege, right?
Right, I mean, right. But
I get that there's an alternative argument you're making, but what is your actual substantive response to that assertion that appellant is making?
So our argument is that fraudulent concealment does not apply. And even if the elements of fraud are met, fraud is still, well, first we argue that the fraud claim is a recast healthcare liability claim subject to a 2-year statute of limitations because it's based upon Dr. Heitkamp's original treatment back in 2019, and it requires expert testimony to be able to determine whether or not he breached the standard of care. And the Texas Supreme Court, the Texas Supreme Court has made clear that when expert testimony is needed to determine whether a claim has been breached, that it has to be a healthcare liability claim. And then fraudulent concealment does not apply because this court held in Kuzmin versus BiPro Inc. in 2024, stated, even if fraudulent concealment applies, it does not extend the limitations period indefinitely. The limitations period is told only until a party learns of facts, conditions, or circumstances which would cause a reasonably prudent person to make inquiry, which if pursued would lead to the discovery of concealed cause of action.
Well, is it not reasonable for a plaintiff to feel that you know they've got an expert that they're looking to accurately and honestly assess a situation? I mean, are plaintiffs expected to go get a second medical opinion? I mean, how would the Jordans know that Dr. Heitkamp was being anything other than honest until he was put under oath in January of 2023?
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, whether or not Dr. Heitkamp's opinion on causation is true or false is irrelevant for the purpose of fraudulent concealment because fraudulent concealment depends upon whether the plaintiff knew of the injury and the facts that the injury existed. So, for example, in Burton v. Labor, which is a 2019 decision from this court, the plaintiff argued that the physician fraudulently concealed the negligence that caused vision loss in her eye after surgery because the physician failed to forward her medical records. In Burton, the evidence showed that plaintiff was aware within months of her surgery that her vision was not improving and had actually become worse. And this equated to knowledge of her claim and rendered fraudulent concealment inapplicable as a matter of law.
Well, isn't this a little bit different, though? I mean, Mr. Jordan certainly knew that he had been injured and he was actively pursuing a claim against what he thought, based on Dr. Heitkamp's opinion, was the correct wrongdoer to be going after.
So I would argue that the cases are very similar because in both cases, Burton didn't know the cause of her injury. The cause of her injury were in the medical records, but they kept the medical records from her. So, but the Burton case still said that fraudulent concealment didn't apply because she knew of her injury because she knew of the symptoms. Similar to this case, Mr. Jordan was aware of his symptoms and he knew he had an injury. Further, Dr. Heitkamp provided the medical records when he was asked for them. So, similar to Burton, Mr. Jordan knew of the injury, even if he didn't know of causation. And so then, because fraudulent concealment does not extend limitlessly, it stops when they discover the injury. So that was back in 2019.
And Burton says it stops when they discover the injury.
So Burton states, when a party learns of facts, conditions, or circumstances which would cause a reasonable person to make inquiry which, if pursued, would lead to the discovery of the cause of action. And then it states that her knowledge of her symptoms equated to knowledge of her claim. And so so her knowledge that she was injured is the claim, because the cause was still concealed from her because she didn't have the medical records, but the court still found that fraudulent concealment did not
make it indefinite.
Yes. Okay. So all appellant's claims are recast healthcare liability claims. There's no dispute that the negligence and gross negligence claims are healthcare liability claims, but appellant's fraud claim is also subject to the 2-year statute of limitations for the same reason that I stated earlier, that it requires expert medical testimony. This is not knowledge known by the general public and not something that the general public could opine on, and requires testimony from an expert to determine. And then, secondly, Dr. Heitkamp conclusively established that the 2-year statute of limitations bars all of appellant's claims. Appellants did not dispute that the continuous treatment rule applies, and they agree that the date of accrual under general rules of principles was the last date of treatment. The continuous treatment rule often arises in suits alleging misdiagnosis or mistreatment. The continuous treatment rule applies where the patient's inquiry occurs during a course of treatment for a particular condition, and the only readily discernible date is the last day of treatment. Therefore, the last date that the doctor treats the patient controls the running of limitations in these situations.
So you're saying that would have been when he was discharged after surgery to
Yes.
the rehab hospital?
That was March 22nd, 2019.
So you disagree that as the appellant says, that when Dr. Heitkamp was actually examining Mr. Jordan and writing his at least first report, and I guess the second one too, that constituted treatment?
Yes, we disagree. However, even if it were considered treatment, because he did Dr. Heikamp did see Mr. Jordan in February 9th, 2021. February 9th, 2021. As his capacity, he said it in his deposition as treating physician and expert witness. So there could be an argument that February 9th, 2021 was treatment. But even then, it's still outside the two-year statute of limitations.
So did Dr. Heikamp see Mr. Jordan again before he issued his May 2022 report? Do we know?
It's not in the record.
Okay.
I have no knowledge of whether he did, but there's nothing in the record that shows that he did.
When you research this, I mean, this is quite novel. A doctor who's a treating physician also writing a report. Did you find anything, any kind of case law or any kind of precedent where that situation had occurred before?
No, not to my knowledge. However, this case does not hinge on the alternative argument. So these are recast healthcare liability claims that occurred back in 2019, and fraudulent concealment does not apply because he was aware of his injury in 2019. And also, the argument that Dr. Heikamp, his deposition was the beginning of the accrual. This argument was not made at the trial court and is not properly presented adequately for this court to review. But secondly, we don't believe that a reasonable jury could find that Mr. Jordan was providing treatment to a patient while taking his deposition.
So, and I'm sorry, I'm not as familiar with the record certainly as you are, but so are you saying that when the plaintiff responded to Dr. Heitkamp's summary judgment motion, there was no argument there that the deposition started the running of limitations?
No. The latest that he argued that the last date of treatment occurred was the May 4th, 2022 report. The appellant does argue that the tolling period applies. So a 75-day tolling period occurs when you provide notice of claim. However, notice of claim is sent, and then according to Chapter 74, this must be at least 60 days before the filing of the suit. The appellants only waited 56 days. And
I'll ask your question about that. In the reply brief, they complained that she didn't raise this complaint below. What is your response to their reply brief argument?
We did discuss the tolling in the complaint below. We were aware of two notices of claim, the June 3rd and the July 18th, and we stated how these notices of claim were not applicable because they were filed after the suit was filed. So we discussed how his notices of claim did not apply.
Did you discuss the 56 versus 60-day piece specifically?
We discussed that when notice of claim is defective, the 75-day tolling period does not apply.
They also complained that you didn't make a specific denial under Texas Rule of Civil Procedure 54. Did you specifically deny that all conditions precedent had not been met? That's a complaint they make in their reply brief.
All conditions precedent. I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
They complained that you didn't comply with Texas Rule of Civil Procedure 54 with regard to the condition precedent, that you didn't plead that. Did you plead that?
The condition precedent. I would be happy to write a brief on that after this. I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that question at the
moment.
That's
okay. Thank you.
If you don't mind, and I don't want to just throw you off track too much, but I kind of like to get to you. Remind me, when we're talking about a fact issue or the lack thereof, you know, what was your position on that? That, you know, I think your position was that they never put forward a fact issue to pass summary judgment. Isn't that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, and how so?
So because no date that they provide can take this claim inside the statute of limitations. And secondly, fraudulent concealment does not apply, and they did not give facts that could dispute that. So while, yes, we say even if this later date applies to the accrual of the statute of limitations, that is not a material fact that would affect the outcome of the case, because no matter what date they picked, besides the deposition date, which we believe that a reasonable jury could not agree that that was treatment, no matter what date they pick, it's not a material fact that would affect the outcome of the case.
And there was no findings in this case, correct? And we're not sure why the judge ruled the way the trial judge ruled the way the trial judge ruled, correct?
Correct.
And as far as you know, nobody requested findings on either side?
Correct.
Okay.
Briefly, just to address the issue of whether this claim was told by the 60 days or by the notice of claim. It was filed 56 days. We cite to this court's case in Flanagan, where it said that for a notice of authorization form to toll limitations period, 75 for 75 days, they must be sent at least 60 days before filing the suit. This case, Flanagan, was also cited in a Northern District Court case in Texas, which stated the exact same thing, that it was not sent 60 days before the suit was filed, so the plaintiff was not afforded the 75-day tolling period. Okay. And for the reasons stated, we ask you to please grant and affirm the trial court's judgment granting Dr. Heikamp's motion for summary judgment. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have two questions right off the bat for you. This Section 74 argument about a 56 days versus 60 days, you know, what's your response to that? And then two, if it wasn't specifically addressed at the below, then how so?
Thank you. That was the first thing I was going to address. So the first response is that 56 versus 60 days is what's been termed a technical error, if that were the case, by the Supreme Court. And if it's a technical error, the proper remedy is abatement. It's not dismissal. That's number one. Number two, the notice of the claim issue was not properly before the trial court. It was not something that was brought up in their original motion for summary judgment. And if it were properly before the court, we would have produced evidence of two prior notices that were sent on September 22nd, 2023, and on October 12th, 2023, two addresses which we are pretty sure were good addresses for Dr. Heikamp. And that creates a fact issue for the jury as to when he received notice. And what was there another question that I?
Well, just, no, I think you covered it.
Okay. The other thing that I wanted to bring up is I want to talk about fraudulent concealment a little bit very quickly. Fraudulent concealment is a doctrine. It is not a law. So it does not replace the two-year statute of limitations for Chapter 74. The purpose of the doctrine of fraudulent concealment is to prevent misuse of a statute. So in this case, fraudulent concealment absolutely applies to this case.
Well, the case that she cited, that our case from 2019, how do you distinguish that?
So
Burton, I think it's Burton.
Is that the one with the medical records request?
Yeah.
So the question in that case, or the reason that this court held as such in that case, was that they held that the plaintiff did not make a reasonable inquiry once they didn't get their records. In this case, a reasonable inquiry was obviously made by the hiring of an attorney to investigate the claims, who contacted the treating surgeon, who asked him, hey, what happened here? And then whatever they talked about, he agreed to be the retained expert witness. Based on that, a lawsuit was filed, which was litigated up through depositions. So a reasonable inquiry was definitely made in that case. And each time that he's not telling, that he's consulting with counsel, and he's not telling him the true cause of the injury here, that's fraudulent concealment every single time.
Could that concealment go on indefinitely, in your view? I mean, let's say that Dr. Heidkamp hadn't been deposed in 2023.
I don't know that indefinitely is the right word, but I think as long as he's actively concealing it, as long as the case is going on, then yes. I mean, it can go on. I think it has to be reasonable. I mean, if something came out during litigation, in this case it was the deposition, but you know, at some point, then yeah, it becomes incumbent on the Jordans to know that, hey, the case is really against Dr. Heidkamp, not Dr. Rappa. I mean, he's got to figure that out at some point, and I think in this case he figured it out exactly when it was admitted by the doctor, which was January of 2023.
Let me ask you a question, because it's so novel to me. In your research, had you seen a situation in anywhere, in any of the cases, where a treating physician later wrote an expert report in the very same case?
I don't think I've seen it in an appellate sense. I mean, it's always something that's crossed my mind, as who's in a better position to talk about negligent treatment than a treating surgeon who maybe fixed a problem. But I think that what we run into most of the time is that those experts know that they could be the responsible third party, so they're not somebody who wants to opine as the expert, which only leads credence to our theory in this case that Dr. Heidkamp knew that he was a target if another expert got a hold of it, and therefore he took the reins on it and said, well, let's make a case against somebody else, not me.
Yeah, I mean, there might be a trial strategy in asking a doctor to write that letter and say, point the finger at that guy.
Right, and I think the last thing, with respect to the fraud, there's been a lot of talk about recast healthcare liability claims. With respect to fraud, it doesn't matter if it's a healthcare liability claim or not. Again, the statute for fraud is 4 years, which it would be within that. But in this case, the fraud was continuing through January of 2023. So even if it's a healthcare liability claim, regardless, it's 2 years from January 2023, which would be 2025. So we're within the statute. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Oral argument has been very helpful. Your case has been submitted, and you're free to go about your afternoon. Thank you very much.